ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Record damages in a sexual harassment case make it very clear courts won't tolerate employers who intimidate complainants.
It's incredibly important because it's been a classic playbook in responding to sexual harassment claims to victim blame, to shame victims, to subject them to performance management or misconduct allegations, or to find other ways to intimidate them and discourage them from pursuing complaints.
Why the federal court threw the book at the employer who tried to punish a worker for speaking out. That's coming up. Hi, Damien Carrick here. Last week on The Law Report, we discussed new research that found Australian lawyers continue to use non-disclosure agreements in sexual harassment settlements. This is despite a global campaign to outlaw their misuse. A central figure in this movement is Canadian Emeritus Law Professor Julie McFarlane, the co-founder of advocacy group Can't Buy My Silence. She says NDAs first emerged in California decades ago, but were never designed to be used in sexual harassment cases.
There is a very interesting history here, Damien, which I think helps us to understand what's gone wrong, which is that in the 1970s in Silicon Valley, there was, of course, an enormous amount of innovation and research happening around new computer technologies. And at that point, the only way that those companies could protect the new developments that they were coming up with was, of course, through the intellectual property system. But, you know, it takes a little while to get something patented or trademarked and so forth. Or a very old doctrine called restraint of trade, which allowed them to prohibit their employees from working for a competitor for a certain length of time. But the judges didn't like restraint of trade very much. I mean, I think for good reasons, they didn't think that people should be that constrained for too long, and they always put limits on how long they could be for. So NDAs were basically invented because they were indefinite. They are contractual agreements to indefinitely not disclose whatever it is that's been identified as confidential. So they're a little bit like diamonds, you know, they're forever.
And so that's the original history of them. That's how they kind of emerged and became prevalent in the law. But they then began to be used in cases of sexual harassment and other employment law disputes.
Yes, exactly. What has happened, and we're not exactly sure yet of the time frame, because obviously we're talking about secret settlements here, and it's hard getting information about secret settlements, but it appears that in the last 10 or so years, maybe 10, 15 years, there has been this gradual morphing of non-disclosure agreements being used for that purpose that we just talked about, which, by the way, you know, the campaign has no comment on. That's perfectly legitimate. Instead, they've morphed into being used in pretty much, we're told, 95% of settlement agreements for any kind of civil claim. So if somebody makes a complaint against their employer or an individual that is the result of sexual harassment, sexual misconduct of some other kind, sexual assault, or indeed discrimination, what's going to happen, because that incident in and of itself presents a threat to the reputation of the organization or the employer if it becomes known, and that's what's being covered up in non-disclosure agreements. And as I've said, they are now default in those settlements. So, for example, we even see them in consumer dispute settlements or professional services dispute settlements. You cannot speak about this ever to anyone.
And you describe it in the context of sexual harassment complaints. You describe NDAs as allowing to, quote, pass the trash, allowing people to kind of move from one organisation to another without consequence.
Correct. Because what they're doing is effectively, I mean, sometimes this is in practice what happens also, but they are cleaning the slate for the person who is the perpetrator. We know that it's very common for some behaviors to be repeated many times over before any action is taken in a workplace. And we are only really just at the beginning of learning how to deal with things like sexual misconduct in the workplace. And so there's usually been a long history of complaints, and then eventually it gets bad enough that it becomes something that is the subject of a termination conversation, perhaps following an investigation. And the whole slate is wiped clean. The person who is being given the NDA often will receive a short letter of recommendation from the institution, saying nothing about the fact that they have been investigated and found to have behaved in a particular way. And so new employers of that person, and indeed new employment colleagues, have no idea of the history.
So to clarify, we've been speaking about NDAs where a complainant or a survivor is asked to sign that and never disclose what has happened to them. There are also NDAs where the employer and the alleged perpetrator together sign the NDA, and that way the employer is prevented from ever speaking about what happened.
That's correct.
Now, you became very concerned with this type of NDA when you became aware of a colleague who you say sexually harassed his students. Tell me about this extraordinary case.
Well, this was someone who was on faculty at my law school for about 10 years, and there had been for a long time stories about his behavior and inappropriate relationships with students. And then I chose to myself publicly speak out as a survivor of sexual abuse and rape because I was very conscious that there would be a lot of young women in the law school who'd had a similar experience. And I thought that by my speaking out, that might give them some encouragement that life could go on. But it was also because I knew that there were lots of stories out there about my colleague, but the students were too frightened to go to a faculty member to tell them. So once I'd done that, I kind of signaled that I was, you know, open to hearing other people's stories because I had stories from my own life. And that was when I then started to hear directly from student victims. And because this individual also traveled with our student moot team, I started to talk to students in other universities who'd been involved in those competitions who he had also sexually harassed. So there was a very, very long charge sheet here. The university investigated, which was the right thing to do. They terminated him because they found that there was sufficient evidence to show that he had done this and abused his power. And he left the university. But then I started to get calls from other law schools to whom he'd applied for a new job. And that was when I realized, as was the case, that they'd given him a non-disclosure agreement.
Because when those people called, they knew nothing of the complaints against him at your university.
Of the history of sexual harassment, that's right. And I mean, I have the document now, the settlement document now myself. A guilty person with a conscience sent it to me some time later. And in that document, which is between the university and the faculty member, it promises to wipe the HR records clean and to provide him with a letter of recommendation.
So when these people called you up from other universities saying, hey, should I employ this man, did you then tell those people what
the
you
truth.
Knew?
Yes.
So what was the consequence for you of telling that information to these people?
Well, the consequence was that he then, my former colleague then sued me for defamation, because he knew that I needed the information that was contained in the settlement agreement and NDA to be able to prove what had happened. And I didn't at that point have access to any of those documents. Those were between himself and the university. So as a 30-year employee and, you know, one of being at the highest rank in the university, distinguished university professor, I, with some confidence, went to my president and said, this is what's happened. This is a good example of why you shouldn't give people NDAs. I'm now being personally sued for defamation. Will you please make sure that your insurer, who will defend me, has a copy of the settlement agreement so we can prove that this was what happened and the letter of termination? And they absolutely refused to do so. In fact, the insurer refused to defend me to begin with, but we won that case very easily. So the result was that in Trinidad, the hearing took place.
To clarify, you were sued in Trinidad and Tobago by this academic. He was saying he was being denied jobs in that jurisdiction, perhaps?
He was applying in that jurisdiction and he was applying in others as well, but he certainly applied in that jurisdiction and that was where he was based. So his claim was that I was besmirching his reputation and I didn't have any evidence to back up the allegations. And he was correct. The evidence was, you know, held by the university, and the university refused to submit that evidence to the Trinidadian court. I mean, they didn't have to, and they didn't. I couldn't call any witnesses because this was in Trinidad. And so there was an extremely short hearing. There was also no cross-examination made of him by the representatives of the insurance company for the university. So after a very short hearing, there was a judgment that gave him the defamation order and fined me, which the insurance company paid, fortunately. And since then, I have been subject to this defamation order, which says that I'm not to repeat these defamatory, so-called defamatory statements. But the problem, Damien, is that they're not defamatory at all. They're all true. And I now, as I say, have the documents from the university and could, if ever challenged again, prove that because I have his letter of termination, which is 3 pages long. I have his NDA and settlement agreement. And I also have his recommendation from the university, which is somewhat bizarre, next to the termination letter.
The NDA was signed between this academic, this male academic, and the university. Were any of the people who came forward to complain about him, to complain about sexual harassment, were those complainants, were those people asked to sign NDAs?
No, they were not, because there was no formal resolution of the process between him and any one of the victims. They spoke to the investigator. The university decided that it was clear that this behavior had taken place, but there were no individual settlements for the students. I mean, their relief was that he'd left until they realized what had happened with the NDA. And there's no necessity, there's no requirement that the employer in this case has to get the victim to agree. In fact, after I was sued for defamation, many of the student victims were very, very anxious for a long time that he would then turn around and sue them too, because the university obviously wasn't going to help anybody who tried to defend themselves against this man.
And do you all keep in contact in case there are new legal developments down the track or there are legal actions? So you'd be there to support each other?
Yes, exactly. But I think that's extremely unlikely to happen now. It's been a while.
So you're one of the co-founders of Can't Buy My Silence, along with Zelda Perkins, and she's a very important person. Can you tell us who is Zelda Perkins?
So Zelda was the first woman to break her NDA with Harvey Weinstein. She did that back in 2017. And since then, you'll realize there have been a number of other women who have followed suit, who have done the same thing. But Zelda was the first. She was the inspiration. She had gotten to the point that, as she has told me, that, you know, she was prepared to go to prison for telling the truth. She just couldn't stand the idea any longer that he was still out there, still assaulting and raping women. And so she stepped forward and broke her NDA. And she's my partner in the campaign. We met each other after I had had the experience I've just described to you. We met each other online, and like all the best people do now, because Zelda's based in the United Kingdom and I'm based here in Ontario, Canada. And within a very short period of time, and this was by this point, I had left the university because I was disgusted with how they behaved. I resigned my position of 30 years, ended a 40-year career as a law professor, and we began Can't Buy My Silence, which we launched in September of 2021 and has achieved all kinds of things now, both in the UK and in Canada, in terms of changing the law so that we can't have people going through these situations again.
Let's talk about what has been achieved. But before we do that, Zelda was the PA to Harvey Weinstein, I think, in the 1990s.
Yeah.
In the UK. A colleague came forward and revealed to her that Weinstein had tried to rape her. So she confronted him about that and
yes,
supported her colleague. So in 1998, she and this colleague, they signed a 35-page NDA, which contained things like, yes, he will go get therapy. He will never do this again.
That's right. Yes, that's right.
20 years later, Zelda Perkins realizes that he's paid off a lot of women. There are many, many survivors of many, many terrible crimes. And she decides, despite this watertight NDA, she has to speak up and contribute right to bringing down the giant.
That's exactly right.
You're now very much involved in this Can't Buy My Silence. What has been achieved? I've been learning about legislative change in some countries. Can you walk me through what has been achieved?
Sure. I mean, first of all, maybe I should say that Zelda and I decided fairly quickly that our goal needed to be legislative change. We wanted to raise people's general awareness of the issue because, of course, people who have signed NDAs remain trapped in silence. And we wanted to raise people's general awareness and to provide a safe place that people could speak about their experience, which is why we have an anonymized testimonies page on our website. And we saw legislation as being the way that we could prevent people being required to sign NDAs again, and also the way that employers and perpetrators could no longer be allowed to simply pass the trash to other organizations. And so we have what we call the model bill, which we originally collaborated on with a team in the Republic of Ireland, because they came to us first and said they wanted to do this, and has since then been brought forward in Canada, because we have a provincial system. Well, we have a system very like you have in Australia with both state and federal jurisdiction over employment law. So it's being brought forward in Canada in the provinces where most of the control over employment law exists. It would ban the use of NDAs for sexual misconduct and harassment and discrimination and bullying of all kinds. And it sets up a whole series of conditions that would have to be met for something to be enforceable. And once those conditions were met, it would no longer be an indefinite, not time-limited, all-inclusive agreement. So we have had the legislation passed in Prince Edward Island. That happened very quickly. It happened probably because, and this is very typical, there was a local person who was very powerful, who was well known for having multiple NDAs with women for sexual harassment. That person was at the time the president of the university in Prince Edward Island. He is no longer the president of the university in Prince Edward Island. So it passed there, and it has been brought forward in British Columbia, Ontario, Manitoba, and Nova Scotia. And we also have one other little piece of success, which is that in Ontario, the government has accepted new legislation that for universities specifically, they will no longer be allowed to use NDAs for specifically faculty sexual misconduct. And I think, to be honest, Damien, that came about as a result of my case, which was extensively discussed in the debate. So what the university did, in my experience, could no longer happen in Ontario, but it could happen in other parts of the country. And what we want is for this to be law everywhere.
So not just to make sure that survivors don't sign or aren't forced to sign or pushed into signing NDAs, but also that organisations
Exactly.
Will not do that. Coming full circle, we started with NDAs emerging in the USA in Silicon Valley. They've also, at the state level in the USA, been a lot of interesting legislation which has been passed, which is looking at NDAs. We can't really go into detail into all of them, but can you just give me a flavour of some of those pieces of legislation?
Well, a bird's eye view, there are, I think, 19 states now that have passed legislation, and there are a handful of others where it's in process. We have a legislative tracker on our website, and we're constantly having to update it. It's hard to remain current because so much has happened. The work that's being done there is mostly being spearheaded by Gretchen Carlson, who used to work for Fox News, and her partner, Julie Rogensky. And we talk to them, Zelda and I talk to them, you know, continuously, and we do some work together. The states, by and large, have begun with what I would describe as the low-hanging fruit, and they've usually begun by legislating against NDAs for sexual misconduct and harassment. But it is getting broader gradually. There are a number now that also have legislation that forbids NDAs for discrimination and other kinds of harassing behaviors. There's also an organization that has just started up to try to get universities in the US to sign up to a voluntary pledge to stop using them, which is a device that we have used in both the UK and Canada as well. But that's, again, towards the end goal of putting enough pressure on government to pass legislation. But the US has many, many pieces of legislation now, and they are gradually getting broader.
Emeritus Professor at the University of Windsor and co-founder of Can't Buy My Silence, Julie McFarlane, look, thank you for speaking to the Law Report. It's been a very, very eye-opening and important conversation.
Thank you very much for having me, Damien. It was a pleasure.
As we've been hearing, for a complex set of reasons, very few sexual harassment cases go all the way to court. But here in Australia, one such decision is Taylor v. August and Pemberton. Mia Pantekis is a partner with Maurice Blackburn. She's an expert in employment and discrimination law. She acted for the applicant in a federal court case that late last year set a new benchmark for damages in sexual harassment cases.
My client, Fiona Taylor, worked in a jewellery business. It is a small business, and she reported to the owner of the business. They had a close working relationship, but there was an obvious power imbalance between them. Being a small business, there was no HR function or other leadership role where an individual can make complaints about their employment too. And so Ms. Taylor essentially found herself in a situation where her direct manager and the owner was expressing feelings of a romantic nature towards her, gifting her items of jewellery, clothing, and repeatedly making comments about her appearance. And that all really escalated despite attempts to rebuff the advances with a further declaration of romantic feelings, which ultimately left Miss Taylor in a situation where she was incredibly anxious and unable and unfit to return to work.
So it sounds like a complaint was made, conciliation wasn't possible. This proceeded to the federal court. Your client was awarded a total of $268,000 in damages, which I understand is a new benchmark in terms of damages in sexual harassment cases. Why were the damages so high in this case?
The damages are made up of general damages, which compensate a victim of sexual harassment for the hurt, humiliation and distress that they suffer. And that component was $140,000 of the total that you just referred to. And that amount is actually the benchmark for general damages awards under the Sex Discrimination Act. I think there's growing appreciation of the harm that is caused to victims of sexual harassment, and that award of damages sort of reflects that changing community understanding about the impact that this type of conduct has on one's health and well-being.
There was also damages which referenced the victimisation which followed your client making a complaint. So how important
is the acknowledgement that victimisation of a complaint is something which the courts really have to acknowledge in the damages that they award.
I think it's incredibly important because it's been a classic playbook in responding to sexual harassment claims to victim blame, to shame victims, to subject them to performance management or misconduct allegations, or to find other ways to intimidate them and discourage them from pursuing complaints. So I see those tactics being deployed incredibly often in defence to sexual harassment matters, and the fact that the court has come down and sanctioned that behaviour and awarded not only $40,000 in damages for victimisation but also aggravated damages for threats that were made, I think it sends a strong signal that the courts will frown upon those types of behaviours and that there needs to be a rethinking about how organisations respond to complaints and do so in a way that doesn't re-traumatise and expose an applicant to more harm.
Not many cases, sexual harassment cases, go all the way to court, but I noticed that a lot of the recent ones have involved small businesses. Is that because larger businesses, look, there are these HR units which kind of will step in. There are, if you like, legal advice which will step in. Do you get the impression that larger businesses are perhaps better at handling these issues than smaller businesses?
They're definitely better resourced and equipped to get the advice they need to be able to navigate complaints of this nature and a legal process. With smaller businesses, it's sort of the perfect storm because often you don't have a HR function. There's nowhere for the complainant to turn. They're battling a power dynamic and differential that is incredibly difficult and puts their employment at risk if they speak out of turn or are too blunt about how they're feeling about the advances or the conduct of a sexual nature. So I think that's why we've seen some recent cases in those contexts make their way through the courts. And larger organisations, I guess, as I said, have better access to advice, both dealing with the complaint internally and then in the legal process, which sometimes makes a difference in trying to resolve these issues.
And perhaps are more open to cultural change than smaller businesses where, you know, the one individual who is running the business really does hold all the levers.
Well, that's right. When the decision maker is the one that's being accused of the conduct, there's sort of that conflict of interest and inability to be objective, whereas in a larger organisation, you've got layers and presumably the alleged perpetrator is not going to be the ultimate decision maker on how the complaint is being handled. HR will step in. And I'm not saying that large organisations do it well and don't end up in these situations. It's often the case that, you know, complaint handling is bungled in those contexts as well. But those calling the shots on the litigation are unlikely to be the ones that are being accused of having engaged in wrongdoing.
Mia Pantekis, partner with Maurice Blackburn, expert in employment and discrimination law, thank you for speaking to The Law Report.
Thank you.
That's all we have time for today. A big thank you to producer Christina Kukolia and also to sound engineer Brendan O'Neill. You can follow The Law Report on the ABC Listen app. And if you find us on any other podcast platform, please do leave a review, a like, a thumbs up, anything which helps others find the program. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk to you next time with more law.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.